Gurgel. Will begin. He shoots and scores. 1-0 Islanders. Matthew Barzell with his fourth in the last five games.
Islanders country, hello. This is PT Isles, the Soak It In edition. Alongside Noel Fogelman, I'm Isles Blog's Joe Bono. A reminder, you can listen to this show and all Lighthouse Hockey podcasts on iTunes. Please rate and review or find us on Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or over at lighthousehockey.com. Lighthouse Hockey, your SB Nation home for your New York Islanders coverage. Coming up, my interview with New York Post columnist Mike Vaccaro, who gives us his unique perspective on what the Islanders have accomplished and what it means to this fan base. But first, Noel, it has been an eventful week.
I mean,
it has been a joyous week.
It's probably the most exciting, satisfying week I've been an Islander fan. And I'm sure I'm not the only person. I mean, I'm 46 years old, so I pretty much missed the tail end of the dynasty, became a fan, the drive for five. So, you know, that was disappointing. And then all we can go through the next, you know, 40 years, but we're not going to do that now. But the last week, starting with game four win against the Bruins leading up to yesterday, has been fantastic. It's a 4-game winning streak. This team is playing some unbelievable hockey. We're getting some recognition. I mean, polls, you know, we're the America's team now. It's all this stuff. It's just fantastic. You know, we're getting some respect, which, you know, Islander fans are weird because they always look for attention from national media.
And they don't want the respect.
Exactly.
We get the respect. We don't want your respect.
Right.
But we rather have it be in our, you know, in our ammunition more so than anything else at this point.
Right. Yeah. But like starting with, you know, I guess we can start with yesterday. I mean, for the first 58 minutes, that game was like a perfect road game. Unbelievable. But of course, Islander fashion, they never make it easy. So we had a sweat for the last like 2 minutes of that game. That crowd was, it was like they were back in the bubble. That crowd was just atrocious. And
Greg Wyshynski, he tweeted out before the game that there was a good amount of Islander fans in representation. Right. And I was like, okay, you know, Florida, I can see a lot of, you know, Islander fans making that, either making the trip or being there and making sure they get at the game. And, you know, the Lightning fan base is not as rabid to where the point you're not going to be able to get tickets if you want to go. But to the point where you're hearing audibly through the television, let's go Islander chants in the third period, there was really nothing for them to cheer about. So not only was it a crowd that was not revved up at the start that you would expect a game one of a conference final or semifinal, whatever you want to call it this year. They were, so that first 10 minute push that you always have to be worried about on the road, that the Islanders had to get through game one in Boston, game five in Boston, that same, like, can you absorb the first 10 minutes of the game here?
Right.
That didn't even factor in this game whatsoever. And honestly, the Islanders could have been up 1-2. Vasilevskiy had made a number of really big saves. So did Varlamov, but in the first period especially. And then they get the goal from Barzell. Stamkos makes a bad play, turnover to Josh Bailey. That's the wrong guy you want to make a turnover. But he makes an amazing, beautiful pass, springs Barzell, who goes five hole, and they get the 1-0 lead. And from that point all the way up to past the Pulak goal, all the way up to about the 58 minute mark until the Brock Nelson penalty, it was dead. It was a library.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And there's no they didn't mention it, and it's refreshing now to have a broadcast that's not annoying you. You know, we have like the 18. I mean, I wouldn't say the 18 is not fair because Brendan's not doing it. But, you know, you have, what's it called? You know, Kenny Albert, obviously Brian Boucher, Eddie Olch. These guys, you're not Pierre talking about high school in Manitoba.
You get a kick out of Pierre. I know how much he annoys everyone, but no one else does it. To be that dedicated to your shtick, I respect it.
Yeah. But like, no one gives a shit anymore about that. You know, I don't care. Andrews Lee played, you know, was a starting quarterback.
Dinah.
40 and all this. No one cares. Nothing brings nothing to the game right now. But how the previous broadcast team always mentioned, oh, how loud the crowd is, this and that. And they always compared, you know, the Coliseum. Coliseum, fewer people, always louder. You know, it's like, this is going to be like, you could have five people in the Coliseum for game three on Thursday. It'd still be louder than it was in game one in Tampa.
It was weird. John, you know, Cooper said after the game that, you know, maybe his team's head wasn't in the right place for whatever reason going into game one. It almost was like the fans, maybe that was the same thing for them. I'm really curious how both the team and the crowd comes out at the start of game two. Do they feel like, oh, we can lose this series here? You know, we've lost game one. They handled us pretty well. I know we're the defending champions. I know we beat them in six games a year ago. You know, maybe we have to put our best effort forward. And again, both for the fan base and the team. It's going to be really interesting to see how they come out game two.
Yeah, you know, that was a curious comment. I mean, like, the head wasn't in the game.
That's your job.
Right. You're looking to repeat as champions. And that doesn't happen that often. And the fact that you weren't ready for whatever you're going to call this, NHL semifinal, game one, they didn't sweep the Islanders. This wasn't the first round against the 94 Rangers where the Islanders got blitzed. It was a legitimate series, a hard-fought game six. I mean, game one, throw that out. All the other games were legit. So the fact to say that his team wasn't into it and the crowd wasn't into it, it was a little weird. It's like they can never give the Islanders credit. These teams can never give the Islanders credit. You can go back to, you know, Pittsburgh, and then we all know, we'll talk about a little bit with Boston. Give the team credit. They played a perfect road game. Were their heads in it at all? I don't know.
They're just like the hungrier team.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the word that was coming to me. It was like a Rocky III, Eye of the Tiger type of situation, right? Yeah. Like, you know, it's harder to stay on top than it is sometimes.
Yeah.
Than it is the rise to get there. And the Islanders were the hungrier team, it seemed on game one, as opposed to the defending Stanley Cup champions.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, withstanding the first 10 minutes. That's how it's going to be tomorrow. I think it's really going to – they're going to come out flying, I think. And we all know
– and don't give them a power play. That's the key right there. Stay out of the box. Exactly. Don't want to give them an early power play because we know what, you know, 40% clip or whatever they had been at the playoffs.
Right.
And how dangerous they're going to be. But, you know, you don't want to give them a power play in the first 5 minutes of the game or so and, you know, fall behind early that way.
Right, and especially Varlamov has a penchant for giving up early goals. He didn't obviously do it yesterday, but he's done it in the past. So if he can just withstand those first 10 minutes, because I think the crowd will be a little lively. I can't imagine it being completely dead again. But if they can withstand the 10 minutes, I mean, they'll be in good shape.
Yeah, I don't want to get too excited. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a 2016 series against the Tampa Bay Lightning when Shane Prince and everyone else was scoring goals. Yeah. The Islanders, you know, demolished them game one and then didn't win another game that series. Granted, two overtime game losses, games three and four at Barclays Center. So it was closer than a five-game series. But, you know, I've seen this team get blitzed and the series be over in five games after winning a game one. And even if we go way back to 2000 and seven, I think they split the first two games. I think the first four games of the series were all 3-0. It was 3-0 Lightning, 3-0 Islanders, 3-0 Lightning, 3-0 Lightning, and then they lost game five in overtime. So Islanders have gone back to the Coliseum or Barclays Center in the past, split with the Lightning team, and have not come out of it.
Yeah, and they've done that like pretty much every playoff series they've been in. Besides even the sweep with Carolina, and that's when they had home ice. But they come back, you know, with a split, and they just can't close them out of the Coliseum. We all love the Coliseum. It's, you know, it's a home ice advantage, but the Islanders never take advantage of that. They always seem to be, you know, 2-2 going into the fifth game. So they immediately
– even if you go back to, the Washington Capitals series in 2015 where Tavares goal in overtime in the first, whatever that was, 17 seconds.
Right.
And then they're 1-1 and they lose a tight game four. And then they alternate game five, game six, and then lose game seven. So it will be see. We'll see. We haven't seen the Islanders have a situation where they go up 2-0 on the road. They had that opportunity in Pittsburgh. It did not happen. Boston, obviously, a bit of a different story. They get this Zegras goal in overtime to get away with a split. Otherwise, that could have been a very different series.
Yeah.
But we'll see what they're able to do for game two. But you had to be thrilled that if you were an Islander fan. It was the perfect game that they could have played on the road for game one. And they're going to have to play that type of style to beat this Lightning team, who's still very much a favorite in the eyes of most of the NHL experts out there. Let's kind of go back. We've been, you know, I've been busy, had another kid.
A little bit.
My second daughter, Eva, was born 11:29 in the morning of game six. So, you know, streaming game six from maternity ward was not how I expected. Very envious of everyone who's, you know, just a stage of life, right? No, I just very envious of all the people that are at the Coliseum right now, everyone living it up and going all to these meetups. That is great. That is not in the cards right now. I have approached the situation with my wife where I have said, you know, if they were to make the Stanley Cup final, can I just, I don't know. I know we just bought a house and we just had a second kid, but maybe I could spend $1,000 on a ticket to get in, right, you know, because that's how much it might actually be, considering it's 12,000, 12,000, 13,000 people. I think it's going to be 750 to 1,000 probably to get in. So we'll see. But hopefully I can take part in some festivities. Although, listen, it's been pretty cool just to watch, and I've had my daughter in her Islander jersey, and she's got the chant kind of down, my 2.5-year-old. So that's special in its own right. But I am a little envious of all the fun that I'm seeing online right now. But the Bruins series, and you know, I don't know how to feel about it because it was really on a thread. You know, the Cizikas goal, the breakaway, you go down 2-0, you may not dig yourself out of that. And, you know, game three that they lose, you know, what's really interesting as we sit where we are now is after game three, Varlamov was the only reason why they were even in that game. Yeah. And it gives up the Marchand goal in overtime, you know, very, you know, CNI type of shot. And my timeline was flooded with calls of, you got to go back to Sorokin. Yeah. And look where we are now, four consecutive wins for Varlamov. And even though game five got a little dicey in Boston, there at the end, he's been spectacular.
He's been great. I mean, he's obviously the reason why they're still playing. I mean, like you said, my timeline too was just like, get this guy out of here, you know, this and that. He's probably going to finish fourth in Vezina. He should have been in top three. He's had a fantastic year, but that's the beauty about the Islanders the last 2 years. They have these goaltenders. You can play both of them, you know. Thomas Greiss won a game seven. Then they went back to Varlamov the next series. Same thing. You have two goalies who have won four plus games. Yeah, playoff games.
I mean, Trotz is not afraid to go to Sorokin if Varlamov has to come out of a game and then stick with him. And he'll stick with that backup goalie, Greiss or Sorokin, if they're the guy, until they lose.
Right.
Right. He started game one of the Bruins series with Ilya Sorokin. He gave him an opportunity to say, let's see how far this kid can keep on running it.
Yeah.
And he played an okay game. He didn't play a bad game. He didn't play an awful game. It was an average game that he played.
Right.
You know, the Islanders overall as a team need to be better in game one to win that. And but he said, okay, I'm going back to the guy who got me to game six of the conference finals a year or so ago. And, you know, even though he gave up that early goal in game two, he came back and he's got a very short memory. And you got to have a ton of confidence in him. Moving forward, and it would take a lot for him to come out of the net at this point.
Yeah, I totally agree. But I mean, like a lot of the, you know, going back to Boston, I mean, they win game five and they held on. Were their officiating play a part? I mean, officiating hasn't been great altogether. I mean, I didn't really see too many bad penalties that were called on the Islanders or are called on the Bruins or not called on the Islanders. But the Islanders, you know, got three power play goals, which never happens. You know what?
Never happens.
Yeah. Stop them. You know, if you have a really good penalty kill and your team, your opposing, you know, team is having a struggling power play, stop them. Don't give up three power play goals. You know, you have the chance. What Bruce Cassidy said in the post game of game five was just, he was, you know, razzled. He was just being very immature, non-professional, and he thought that the tide would turn. And it turned because the Islanders basically blew the Bruins out of the water in game six. But Barry Trotz, you know, did a great job kind of, you know, testing the waters with the whole Bergeron thing about him cheating on faceoffs, which he does, but he's, you know, he's one of the greats, and he can do, he gets away with it. Someone finally called him out. Linesman saw that. He got booted out a couple times. Of course, the Bruins, you know, took obsession to that. But you know what? That's why Trotz is the Hall of Fame coach. He did it the right way. Mm-hmm. Not whining and complaining like Bruce Cassidy did that warrant.
He stole $25,000 t-shirts, though.
Was that?
Cassidy sold a lot of t-shirts.
Oh, he did. Oh, my God. Yeah, that's brilliant. He got the New Orleans Saints involved. I'm sure every one of the fan base has a New York Saints t-shirt. And, you know, it's God bless to, you know, Vintage Ice Hockey and Yes
No Pun Intended
Outfitters. They all have jumped on the train here, and, you know, rightfully so. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that again, that series, though, I mean, the Islanders got outplayed in Game 5 badly.
Yeah.
They could have easily lost Game 2. You know, it was a very tight series. It was a really good game series between the Islanders and the Bruins. That was great series. Game 6, obviously, you didn't get a classic Game 6. Islanders handled them pretty well.
Right.
But other than that, yeah, what a great series. And you were literally holding your breath every time the perfection line was out there. Mm-hmm. You know, even with Pelech and Pulock, it didn't matter who the Islanders were matched up against. Obviously, when they were in Boston, they got the last change and had an opportunity to kind of match up a little bit better. But, man, you know, you knew that the Islanders were the better team, but that line was just so dynamic that it could have been enough to carry them off. And, you know, I don't love the fact that we learned about the Tuukka Rask injury after the fact like this. I mean, you heard that he was banged up and then, you know, he had a maintenance – yeah, it's a maintenance day, and that's why he was pulled before the start of the third period in Game 5. You know, you don't love hearing that, but I don't think the Islanders care. I don't think their fans care either. I mean, Pierre was waxing poetic about Tuukka Rask throughout the series, even with how well he was playing, even with that injury. But you know, it's just amazing now we've gone back-to-back seasons with all of these handshakes at the end of series after going so many years without them, and back-to-back series being clinched on home ice and these really special moments at the Coliseum. You know, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but we talked about it on a previous show where Patrick Dowd, the sign guy back in, you know, 2015, had a sign that says the barn stays open until a fifth Stanley Cup. And I mean, if you have a scenario where they leave the arena and then come back and allow that for to happen, I mean, that is some magical stuff.
Right. Like I said, I don't want to get too far ahead, but let's hypothetically they make it to the Stanley Cup. They're not the Eastern Conference champions. They're not the Whales. I mean,
no, I think they are. I think they said the winner of this series will get the Whales. Yeah. So, I mean, the way it ended up factoring out, though, because of the seeding, when Montreal won, you knew that the winner of Colorado and Vegas was going to get that. You kind of got this, you know, typical kind of Eastern Conference matchup. You didn't get any of these really crazy matchups. Obviously, Montreal playing Vegas is not expected, but we didn't get two series that were very much out of whack.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's like, for t-shirt purposes, like, what do you put down? Are you just putting Stanley Cup final? You know,
hopefully you don't have to put anything. I've been a fan of teams, and I've gone out and I've run out. I remember 2000, I ran out and I got the NL champion New York Mets 2000 t-shirt, like, in between. It was like 6 days between the start of that and the World Series, and I couldn't wear it after the series was over.
All right, I got the Yankee World Series one, so
right. So I mean, that's the thing. Yeah, I don't think. I mean, maybe, I'm sure a lot of people would go out and buy them, but I would hold my money and hold out hope that you're buying a Stanley Cup champion t-shirt at some time in merchandise. There's just so much excitement, though, happening, you know, at the Coliseum, and I just want to give a ton of credit to, you know, the Islander organization. I think what they've done by bringing the Jets players around has been a lot of fun. I mean, the Dan Feeney, and then they have a T-shirt with him with his silhouette out there. They're raising money for charity. Yeah. Obviously, having Zach Wilson at the games, Damian Woody, who's now been a staple for a number of period of time. And you've had some other celebrities there too, as all people that maybe aren't always at the forefront of Islander games. And then just seeing the excitement that John Ledecky has around here, you know, had a great Giannotti was at the games from WFAN, and Ledecky was behind him and take that, Boomer. Right. Yeah. He's just in there. He's with the crowd. He's experiencing it out in the corridor, giving these chants, beating the drum. I mean, he's been doing that kind of stuff since the very start, writing the LIRR, being, you know, at the Coliseum. But I don't know another owner that's doing this. And, you know, he was doing it well before they were in playoff games, but man, he's hit a grand slam with him and this ownership group. They must be on cloud nine having this type of team and this type of run heading into a new building next year.
Oh, I mean, like, everything has gone right. I mean, Ledecky even a couple years ago came to Bridgeport and was, you know, taking pictures of the fans, high fives, handing out, you know, free swag. So, I mean, this, and like, it's the perfect compliment to Scott Malkin, who's basically just in the background and letting, you know, John Ledecky just do all the fun stuff, you know, be the, you know, figurehead, so to speak. But I mean, the arena, the team, Trotz, you know, Lou, I mean, everything's fallen into place, and it's just like, we're waiting for, you know, the clock to strike midnight, but it hasn't yet. And it may not, and let's hope it doesn't, because this is fantastic. They're three wins away from making it to the Stanley Cup. I mean, after last year, where, you know, it was a great run, but the fans couldn't enjoy it. The fact that they're doing this again the year after, closing out the Coliseum, and they have two clinching games at the Coliseum. I mean, hasn't been that since 93. It's just like, just ride this.
Well, when was the last time they actually had a lead at a conference final or semifinal, right? You have to probably go back to the 1984 team that ended up losing to Edmonton, right? So it's exactly. been that long that was... before they've actually led a series right. this far out. 93, they got behind to the Canadiens and, you know, lost in five games.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, I love these Lou Lamoriello still shots because, you know, he's probably not even smiling through the mask. But the fact that they go to him after these great moments and he's just even more stoic than humanly possible, like no emotion. You don't even get to see whether or not he's grinning behind the mask is even a little bit that much perfect. I'm very curious what's going through the head of Anders Lee. I mean, you've had some videos of him on the ice, you know, skating and doing some drills. He's probably just, you know, doing that to get back into hockey shape.
Yeah.
It's got to be a weird feeling being any player that's a big part of a team and not being on the ice, but to necessarily be the team captain as well and see your team going on that type of a run. It's got to be mixed emotions. You got to be thrilled for your friends and how close this team is. And I'm sure he's still very much a presence in the room. But it's got to be an interesting feeling for him to see Paul Mary and Zajac make these type of contributions and knowing that, you know, they're not here if he's healthy.
Right. And, you know, you can look at it. He's had some bad luck. I mean, was it 2016? He broke his leg, so he couldn't enjoy that run as well to the second round. So he's had a little bit of bad luck in these playoffs. But going back to Boston real quick, everyone was just killing the Islanders for getting Paul Mary, who did nothing in the regular season. He scored two goals in like what, 17 games. Taylor Hall changed the fortunes of Boston. What did Taylor Hall do in the playoffs? One empty net goal. While Paul Mary was dominating, he has seven goals in the playoffs. He looks great. So that's another trade that's worked out for Lou. And Travis Zajac, who scored the goal in game six, he's been fantastic. You know, he's keeping Oliver Wahlstrom out, who's looks like he's ready, but Barry's going with the hot hand. Why would you change it anyway? I mean, at this time of year, you got the experience, keep him in there. Absolutely.
And, you know, Paul Mary, again, you have these dreams of whether or not he's going to be able to get re-signed, and it seems unlikely, but I mean, whatever, you know, you'll be okay.
Yeah. That's what you worry about for a month now.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, my interview with New York Post columnist, Mike Vaccaro. You're listening to PT Isles, part of the Lighthouse Hockey Podcast Network. We're back, PT Isles, Joe Bono with you, now joined by one of the great sports columnists in New York, if not the entire country, a native Long Islander that grew up with the Dynasty Islander teams of the 80s. That's the New York Post, Mike Vaccaro, and he joins me now. Mike, appreciate you taking the time to give us some perspective on this current Islander run. Thanks so much for coming on.
Great talking to you, Joe. Looking forward to it.
And you can follow Mike, of course, on Twitter, at Mike Vac. Now, I had you back on late during the 2014-2015 season, final year at the Coliseum. I actually went back and listened to that interview last night, and you talked about how you felt you had earned the championships because you had been a fan of the team since 75. You lived through some heartbreak, 78, 79. You know, but in the column last week, you point out that maybe you had it easy, you know, compared to the 45-year-old under Islander fan like myself, who's 39 now. Talk a little bit about what you meant in that perspective.
Yeah, you know, I was 8 years old when J.P. Parise scored his goal. And look, I mean, they had some tough playoff losses in the next couple of years until they finally scaled the mountain 5 years later. But, you know, they were in the playoffs every year. They were a very good team every year. They won the President's Trophy. This was a team that every year added a Potvin, a Trache, a Bossy, a Bourne, on and on, Tonelli, Butch Goring later on. It was always a good team that you were rooting for. I mean, what you poor guys have gone through through a lot of these years is just awful hockey, but slapstick hockey, you know, and terrible mismanagement and just bad, you know, bad teams. Now, look, I mean, there have been a couple of spasms of prosperity. And, one of the guys I talked to in that story, in that column, you know, talked about the Turgeon hit that year was a great kind of nice little, you know, respite, I guess. But it was really kind of after that things kind of started to go south and stayed south. And to see, you know, not just success, but sustained success now a couple of years consecutively. And also, look, there isn't an Islander fan I know who doesn't have complete faith in the partnership of Lou Lamoriello and Barry Trotz. And to me, when you have that kind of faith in the people who are running the team you root for, I mean, it's easy to get completely invested in.
And to do this with another run at the Coliseum, again, I'll go back to that interview that we had 2014-2015, and it was just about coming out that there may not be an ironclad lease with Barclays, and, you know, you were very – and rightfully so, pessimistic on the idea that some other grand plan could be realized. And here not only is the fan base on the cusp of going into a brand new state-of-the-art arena in Belmont, but they get to experience this playoff run at the old barn in front of just about a capacity crowd, just adds a layer of specialness to it. I think you referred to the Coliseum as the raucous adventureland of ferocity during the Bruins series. And it's, that's what it's been. It's been a special place. And it gets its due on these national broadcasts, and it's so great to see that happen one more time.
Yeah, really, it really is. That's kind of the special part. Look, I mean, I think last year's run had its own significant, you know, moment for a lot of people, especially Islanders fans, because look, I mean, it was coming in the teeth of just a pandemic where our world was upside down. So to be able to tune into Islanders games every other day, regardless of where they were played, was really kind of a joyous thing for. You know, even I think for peripheral fans who might not necessarily have been there for every game otherwise, but, you know, without a real secondary option, you know, really kind of fell back in love with that team last year. But it was different. Look, playing in a – you can see the games that the poor Canadian teams had to play this year and how much different a feeling it is there than it is, you know, in the other places like the Island, like Boston, like Pittsburgh, like Tampa yesterday. Where the, you know, the just hockey playoff atmosphere is really kind of on its own island in terms of, you know, tenacity. And it's great to have that back. It really is. The Coliseum, as we all know, can be an awfully loud place. I mean, all due respect to the Garden, all due respect to Old Yankee Stadium and Old Shea Stadium and so on and so forth, which, you know, could generate its own noise levels. But I've really never known anything quite like the Coliseum in terms of just a ferocity of noise when things start to go well.
Mike, have you had the opportunity yet to tour the new Belmont Arena? I know they've done several different press gatherings and season ticket holders, et cetera. Have you had the opportunity as of yet?
I haven't, but I've been promised one, so I intend to take a good look at it. Every report I've gotten from people I trust is spectacular. Molly Walker, who does such a great job covering hockey for the Post, she took another tour not long ago, and, you know, she couldn't say enough nice things about the facility, and that's great. You know, we all love the Coliseum. You know, I think a lot of us like Shea Stadium too, but, you know, when the time comes and enough is enough, and look, I mean, this has a different feel to it than when they left the Coliseum for Barclays Center, because, yes, it was only Brooklyn, and it was only over the city line, I guess, but it was a different feeling. For one thing, I mean, it was a terrible arena for hockey, but just the, you know, from a spiritual standpoint and from an emotional standpoint, you know, they were playing in Brooklyn. They weren't playing on Long Island. They're going to still be playing on Long Island now, and I think that's going to be a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bring it up just because there was, you know, there's so much about, you know, the new turnover of stadiums and arenas that we've seen in this area, and, you know, the fan base carries over, right? The Met fans carry over to Citi Field, and you have these moments where it does sound similar to the old Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium or whatever it may be, but, you know, maybe it's nostalgia more than anything else, but, you know, obviously I think it's also some new stadium dynamics, but it sounds like this ownership group has really tried to make sure that it carries over that barn, small arena type feel while capturing all the new amenities and state-of-the-art technologies that are available to a fan base. So I'm really eager to see how that carries through.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think they understood. You know, I think that there's a lot that the new ownership group has gotten right. There's a lot that they just seem to understand. You know, I mean, you can't make a fan a fan if he's not going to be a fan. And you know, somebody coming in from the outside can try and replicate, you know, what that's all about, but you know, there's a difference. I think there's a difference between, you know, John Mara and other football owners, because he grew up just living and dying with the Giants. Same thing with you know, with Steve Cohen and the Mets. And you know, look at me, I can't say that I know exactly what the ownership's you know, rooting interests were when they were young, but they've certainly been able to capture and have been sensitive to what Islander fans want, what Islander fans admire, what they like about their current rooting experience. And I think this is going to be a whole lot closer to what we're familiar with in the Coliseum than it ever was when they were playing at Barclays.
New York sports columnist Mike Vaccaro is our guest, P.T. Isles. You tweeted out this a few days ago, quote, "I've said it and written it many times before. If I bought a franchise, any sport, not just hockey, my first call would be Lou Lamoriello bearing a blank check." You know, it's interesting because myself and other Islander fans and people that do what I do, you know, we don't love every move. Every move that's done is not, wow, how did he pull this off? We agree with Lou is doing. But he seems to find the right type of player and the right fit wherever he goes. And more so than that, Mike, how much do we not take into account the culture of accountability and expectations that he just brings by just his mere presence and the few choice words that he uses? I think that is probably what's been most impressive watching him day in and day out now for the last 3 years.
Absolutely. And look, in fairness to what you pointed out about how he isn't perfect, he's infallible. You know, it's also easy to forget that, you know, a good chunk of these players were assembled by Garth Snow. So I think it's kind of unfair that he's kind of like, you know, lumped into the proletariat of all the terrible, you know, just no account people who worked for the Islanders. Obviously, he helped lay a little bit of the groundwork. And I think most Islander fans understand that and appreciate that. They certainly like to pull me back in when I tend to credit everything short of like what struts they used to build the Coliseum to Lou Lamoriello. But here's the thing. I mean, I go back with Lou to the Devils. I covered the Devils as a columnist in the late 90s, early 2000s. And my favorite team that I've ever covered, that includes some championship Yankee teams, two Super Bowl Giants teams, a whole lot of fun Mets and Knicks teams. My favorite single team that I ever covered was the 2 years, 99-2000, 2000-2001 Devils. They won the Stanley Cup the first year. They went to Game 7 the next year. And I got to spend a lot of time around Lou, and I got to talk to Lou a lot. And I was just so blown away by just how impressive he is, how you bring culture. I mean, he does. He's very true. He has a very specific belief in how things are supposed to be done and how they're supposed to be, you know, managed properly, and he doesn't waver from that. And that was apparent in those Devils teams. Look, I mean, he was the guy who was ultimately in charge of the two Nets teams that went to the finals when there was that brief Yankee-Nets alliance. And, yeah, you want to go back, I mean, he was, you know, athletic director of Providence College. He hired a guy by the name of Rick Pitino, who, you know, that sounds like the easiest hire in the world to make now, but in 1985 wasn't necessarily so. I mean, he was the number two assistant coach for the Knicks. So, you know, he knows talent. He knows kindred spirits in terms of, you know, a guy like Barry Trotz. To me, just, you know, they fit together so well. And like you said, he's true to his principles. He's true to his beliefs. And I think that's what I've learned watching him operate. That's why I do think that his skills would look. He's obviously a hockey man. He knows hockey better than any sport. And it's a little bit of a hyperbolic leap to say I would necessarily entrust him with, say, a soccer team. But I would entrust him with a soccer team. I would, because I believe that he knows what he doesn't know, and therefore will hire accordingly and will allow himself to make proper moves based on the advice of people that buy into his system, buy into his culture, and that he trusts implicitly.
And, you know, part of the reason why I appreciate your writing so much is how you connect the dots for generations, I think, of New York sports fans. And I want to maybe get your perspective here, is that we've seen great turnarounds from one year to the next, not just in New York sports, but, you know, in all different types of sports, worse for first type stories. But is there anything that from a cultural shift that you have seen that mimics what the Islanders have gone through from the changing at the top of Ledecky and Malkin ownership group to bringing in Lamoriello to Barry Trotz to a new arena? I mean, it's seismic, the shift. And it goes much further than just on the ice product and standings. Is there anything that rivals that in your mind?
Boy, none that I can think of. And I think, you know, you accurately capture what this is. I mean, Islanders fans were always loyal. But I think they always felt a little bit like they were forgotten by the people who should have been caring about them the most. And I think that's why they stayed away as much as it was the terrible teams. I just think there was a sense among a lot of Islander fans that they just weren't, they just didn't matter to people around the Islanders. And I think that is really kind of the fundamental shift here. I mean, you know, you as an Islander fan, if I would have told you all of the things that are happening right now, you know, even 10 years ago, you probably would have said, well, yeah, maybe that'll happen when they move to Kansas City, but here, and right. It's happened here, you know. I mean, in some ways, I mean, I think it's fair to say that this ownership group has approached this market like a virgin market almost, like an expansion market in terms of wanting to re-recruit even the most loyal fans. I mean, and I think that it was smart. I'm not saying that they were on the verge of losing, you know, guys like yourself and guys like the guys I talk to in my column and, you know, the people you see who flock the Coliseum and, you know, wear their Islanders gear everywhere now. But it was also not a bad idea to remind them that, you know, hey, you know, we value you. We know how important you are to the whole operation of what the Islanders do. You know, the players win the cups, but, you know, you guys are the ones who helped get us there. That was always the sense, kind of the unspoken sense in the 70s and 80s. And it didn't really have to be spoken because it happened so quickly. You know, I mean, the Dialogues were terrible for, what, 2 years? And then all of a sudden they were good. And then they were great. And then they were historic. I mean, that's an incredible rise. I mean, that part you can liken elsewhere, like to the Kansas City Royals or to the Arizona Diamondbacks. But it's this, you know, secondary and tertiary generational thing with the Islanders that I think is unique. I mean, they went through that long wandering through the desert through the 90s and, you know, and beyond. And now to have what you have in place, it's hard not to connect what's happening now with what happened in the glory days, only because it was such a well-run operation under Bill Torrey. They always seemed to get the right player when they needed them. They always seemed that now they didn't have to worry about going out and finding a coach because they had the coach in place. But when I was growing up as an Islander fan, you know, I was also a Mets fan, a Jets fan, Knicks fan. I always felt those teams are going to figure out a way to screw it up. It was always the exact opposite when it came to the Islanders. I just always believed that Bill Torrey and Al Arbor would figure out a way to make things right in the end, and they usually did. And I kind of think that that's the thing that this management group and the ownership group has given to these fans. Like I said, I mean, in some ways, very subtle ways, they've almost re-recruited a lot of you guys to say, look, we know you matter. You've always mattered, but we want you to know. And it's not like they're going to hand you out free tickets or anything, but it's just this, you know, it goes back to the mystical word in sports of culture. I think the culture demands that the fans are included and appreciated for what they do.
Yeah, I love that perspective there about the approach of thinking of this a little bit of an expansion team and then the re-recruitment of the fan base. I think that's really interesting and not one that I heard before. Last question for me, more general New York sports, not just Islanders, but, I mean, are we living in a world right now where the Knicks and the Mets and maybe even the Jets with a new head coach who looks great on TV and wearing an Islander jersey at a press conference, that the competency is coming back to these franchises? And how much do fans just want competency at this point with some of these teams that have been so dreadful and so poorly managed throughout the recent history?
You know, I guess being a sports writer and not really being as invested from a fan's point as they are, I've always kind of shaken my head a lot my Mets fan friends and my Jets fan friends and my Knicks fan friends, who always just kind of wait for the other shoe to drop. You know, always expected to drop, and invariably it drops. But to me, I mean, half the enjoyment of being a sports fan is being able to absolutely back away from the table of reality and logic and reason and just expect things, hope things, believe things are just going to work out for your team. I mean, that's part of what keeps coming back. You don't come back because you know they're going to stink next year. You come back because even though everybody else says that they're going to stink, you think they're going to be okay. Now, they might wind up stinking even worse, and it makes it painful, but it also is what makes it so much, you know, so enjoyable when there is a payoff. I mean, as somebody who grew up, you know, one of about, you know, 6,000 people who would go to Shea Stadium every game, you know, when they won the 86 World Series, I mean, that was an emotional payoff, you know, for me. When I was younger and I was a Nets fan, same thing. I mean, you know, you would follow Dr. J and suddenly they won the championship and you're like, well, I get it. I understand why. And certainly that was the case with the Islanders. I mean, you know, you referenced this earlier about the playoff disappointment, certainly the 1979 series against the Rangers, the year before that against the Maple Leafs when they were clearly the best team in the league. And, you know, when they won the Cup the first time, what they did was they shouted this notion that they were one of the all-time choking teams in sports, which is ironic when you think about them and in their grander legacy. And that's, to me, what the joy of following sports is. But I also understand the cynicism and being jaded and the skepticism, especially because it happens season after season to so many of these teams. So, yeah, I mean, it really is good to actually, like, listen to a Mets fan speak of their team, you know, in such affectionate terms. I mean, it's so nice to have seen the way the Knicks kind of captured their fans' attention, kind of maybe even recaptured their attention and, you know, demanded that they watch every night because they were so compelling to watch. And, of course, you have the same thing with the Islanders now. It's interesting. It's kind of what makes, you know, the Brooklyn Nets so different, because I just don't think that they resonate locally. I think that if they have a popularity base, a lot of it is elsewhere. They're more of a national team than a local team, so it's hard to find a whole lot of people who have the kind of emotional investment in them that you do with the Mets or the Yankees or the Giants or the Jets or the Islanders or the Devils or the Rangers. I mean, it's just a different animal altogether.
That is so true about that. Not to keep you, but I was thinking about this recently because I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, mm-hmm. and so much of me growing up with the Brooklyn Dodgers and that and what that meant for my dad's generation. And I lived in Brooklyn Heights until very recently, had a couple of kids, moved to the suburbs like a lot of people do. And I was telling my wife, I'm like, there is a top basketball team in Brooklyn, New York, and I cannot get excited about it. Like, that is crazy to me if someone would have told me that someone that dons Brooklyn on their professional sports team logo is not a team that I don't have this clear, just instantaneous connection to. But it just has not been there yet. It'll be interesting to see if it ever comes.
The Nets are an interesting case because now I covered them a bunch when I was working in Newark. And I can tell you that, I mean, look, I mean, it was never a fan base that was going to rival the Knicks in terms of numbers. But, you know, people who were Nets fans were genuinely Nets fans. And I think that's partly because they were identified with New Jersey. And it was separate and apart. It really, in its own way, is a different market than New York, even though obviously a lot of New Jersey residents root for New York teams. But the problem with trying to establish a basketball team in Brooklyn, look, I mean, the Knicks play in Manhattan, so I mean, I think people think that Manhattan is like their prime drawing area. I got news for you. Brooklyn, New York is overrun with Knicks fans. I mean, that's mm-hmm. basketball town. You know, that's the basketball capital of New York in a lot of ways. I'm sure Queens and the Bronx would argue, but certainly it's in the top three. And so what you're trying to do is establish a basketball team where there have been basketball loyalties that have been that have been built since 1946. That's hard to do. Now, I think what the Nets are trying to are banking on, in addition to the national fan base, is also, you know, can you develop a new generation of fans who don't really care who their parents rooted for, and who have grown up now in a generation. Like, I don't think that geography necessarily, you know, dictates who you're going to root for. I mean, you can be, you know, an 11-year-old kid on Long Island and decide you want to be an Edmonton Oilers fan, you know, just because you can see their games whenever you want to. Well, you got to stay up late, so maybe that might be a hard one. But certainly, if you wanted to, you grew up a Marlins fan in New Jersey because you can watch their games if you want to. Not that anybody would, but you get my point. And I think that's kind of the thing that the Nets are battling. I mean, they're the Brooklyn Nets, yeah, but I guarantee you that if you took a straw poll of who the most popular team in Brooklyn is, they would probably run at the very worst 70-30 Knicks.
No, they're an interesting use case. You're right, because it's a national team appeal, right? The same way I grew up as a Knicks fan, hated the fact that I had friends that grew up in Brooklyn with me that would wear Michael Jordan jerseys and wear Chicago Bulls paraphernalia because the Bulls were the national team. They can end up, you know, if they go on a good run, these injuries don't end up debilitating their season and knocking them out here against the Bucks in the second round of drawing those fans and making them fans for life. But obviously it did not work out for the Islanders in Brooklyn, but they were having no such problems on Long Island. And hopefully between hockey and other sports, we get a lot of long playoff runs and a lot of full arenas and stadiums in the months to come. But Mike, I really appreciate the time. Love your work. Follow Mike Vaccaro at Mike Vac on Twitter. And hopefully the Islanders get the attention so much so that they get a back page all to themselves in the New York Post. That is my big time goal here.
from your lips to God's ears, Joe.
Thank you, Mike.
You got it. Thank you.